Welcome to 24/7 World Radio Podcast with Brother Eric John Phelps here on this Thursday evening, February 27th, 2025. The title of this podcast is Emergency War Powers Military Jurisdiction. Emergency War Powers, Federal Emergency War Powers, Military Government and Military Jurisdiction, as imposed on us in 1933. Now, this is very, very, very important. And for my listeners, they know that I believe you can understand every topic if you want to. It just has to be stripped away from all the fluff and got down to the very very key, succinct conclusions that are simple. Remember, there isn't anything you cannot understand, listener. My beloved listeners, just keep it simple and it'll be clear as day. Your facts have to be facts. They have to be true. They cannot be inferences. They cannot be suppositions. They have to be facts that are provable. So I will attempt to give you the facts this evening on how we Americans were given Emergency War Powers Military Government on March 9th, 1933, and how we were given Federal Emergency War Powers Military Jurisdiction on April 25th, 1938, as a result of the criminal Erie decision. And so now we've been living since 1938 under an emergency war, since 1933, an Emergency War Powers Military Jurisdiction, and 5 years later, an Emergency War Powers Military Jurisdiction. And that's in every state court and in every federal court. I was in state court in the county of Berks in Pennsylvania, city of Reading, county of Berks. And the court that I was in with my friend as we were seeking to stop a mortgage foreclosure, it was a woman judge, very dominant and controlling. And in that court, she had two flags displayed. One was the federal flag, or I should say the national flag. Remember, we have not had a federal government since July 28, 1868, with the supposed state ratification of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment made federal citizenship for whites, national citizenship for both whites and blacks and Asians and all others. And therefore, we've had, since we have national citizenship, we have national government. On March 9th, 1933, or I should say, yeah, March 9th, 1933, we were given Emergency War Powers Military Government. Civilian government ceased to exist in this country. The flags that would be flown in every court are military colors. The flags that are flown inside of every county courthouse are military colors. The flags that are flown in every federal district court are military colors. The flags that are flown in every in the open areas outside the courtrooms in every federal courthouse are military colors. The flags that are flown in most banks that you'll see when they're flying a flag is a military color. The flags you see in the hotels are military colors. The flags you see in the schools, in the colleges, the universities, indoors, as well as the elementary schools for their assemblies, are all military colors. The flag that is trimmed on three sides with gold fringe and generally has a gold cord with a gold tassel at each end is a military flag called a color. And the question is, how do we get there? This answer will not be provided by anyone unless they've taken my private citizenship class. And generally, you will never hear it from any preacher. You will never hear it from any historian. You will never hear it from any officer of any court. Some of them don't know. But the judges all know. They all know. Because they all go to judges' school and are tutored as lawyers who were just elected or appointed as judges. the secrets of the temple, the secrets of the courtroom. And that secret, the great secret, is this is a civilian court. It's marvelously created by either the Federal National Constitution or it's a state court created by its great and glorious state constitution. So there's nothing wrong with the courts. What's wrong is they're all sitting in a federally conferred emergency war powers military jurisdiction. All of them. And all the judges know it. And it's for the trial or the suing of enemy belligerents one between another, so that this military jurisdiction is most fitting for these enemies and belligerents under Trading with the Enemy Act. Because I will show you how Trading with the Enemy Act was brought inland with the Proclamation 2039, Proclamation 2040, and its jurisdiction was brought over all the courts as a result of the Erie decision on April 25th, 1938. So that's what we're going to cover. I promise I'll keep it as simple as possible. I'll make it a shorter broadcast today, tonight. Well, the first thing we want to remember is we have a Constitution of the United States of America. It's the greatest written constitution for the governance of a people ever written. The greatest. It is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Calvinist document. It is not a Catholic document. It is not a Jewish document. It is not a Muslim document. It's not a Buddhist document. It's not a Hindu document. It is a white Protestant Reformation, Bible-based, Presbyterian primarily, political document. And as Sam Adams says, we have now created a Protestant form of government with the Constitution. It's limited. Well, one other thing, remember the Constitution is divided into seven articles. We want to focus in on Article 1 here. Article 1 is when we the people as a whole, as the sovereign, remember, there's no individual sovereigns here. We as the body of we the people, as the sovereign, delegated our legislative power in Article 1 to the Congress, composing of a Senate and of a House of Representatives. The Senate was to represent the states. That's why every state had two senators, no matter how large or small they were. Each are a sovereign nation state, confederated together in this compact between sovereign states. For certain limited reasons to act as one nation, as set forth in the Constitution, but for all other reasons to still retain their state sovereignty and be state sovereign nations. So we have the Constitution in 1789. It was proposed in 1787. It was ratified by nine states in 1789. And as we look in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, or Subdivision 11, we read this most important statement. In this statement, it tells you congressional power to be used. And there are 18 things that Congress can do. We delegated our sovereign power to Congress to do 18 things. And we read in Article 1, Section 8, where those 18 things are, in Clause 11, we see that Congress shall have power to declare war. It's Congress that has the power to declare war. The last time Congress declared war was in 1941, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when both the House and the Senate declared war, and as validated by the president. The president could not declare war. Only the Congress can declare war. And this is the last time Congress has ever declared war. Why? Because it was given the power to do so by we the people. Congress shall have power to declare war. Well, time passes. We have the war between the states. We have the 14th Amendment that is declared to be passed on July 28, 1868, that begins to centralize power in Washington, District of Columbia. And this is when the old federal citizenship for whites was made national for whites and blacks. And hence, then, the federal citizenship of the federal government was made a national citizenship, broadened into a national citizenship for the new national government. So we have had national government since July 28, 1868. It was still a civilian government, and the due process in the federal courts and the state courts were all civilian due process procedures. None of them were flying military flags in their courtrooms. They were regular flags, the federal being defined by Title IV, I believe. But there's no gold fringe on any flag, because that's a military color. Now, the statute that tells you that a gold fringe flag is a military flag can be found in Army Regulation 840-10. That will tell you there that the military flag of the United States is a flag with gold fringe on three sides. That is a military flag and can be displayed only in parades and inside, namely inside a courtroom. So, Congress was given the power to declare war by the states, the people of the states who ratified it. Now, a point I want to make here is that no war powers were retained by the states. The states, each state delegated all of its power to declare war as a sovereign nation state to the federal, now national government, and they retained no war powers whatsoever. This is important because when you realize that the flags that are flown in every state court and in every state capital, Pennsylvania is flying military colors in its legislature, in its Senate, in the government, in the governor's office, and in the Supreme Court, all these flags are military colors. Does the state of Pennsylvania or any other state have the power, have the war powers, to fly military colors in their state houses? They can't, because they delegated their war powers to the national government and retained none of those war powers. So therefore, what we see is, in all these state assemblies and the legislature and the Senate and all their offices, they are sitting in a federal emergency war powers military government. We do not have state government. The state government has been lost to us as of March 9, 1933, when military government was imposed in over the federal government, the national government, and then that military government went right on down to the states that are subordinate to the national government, which is what the 14th Amendment did. The 14th Amendment subordinated the states to the national government. And if the national government is a military government, well, then all the state governments are military governments. And the governors are nothing more than subordinate commanders in chiefs, subject to the commander-in-chief in District of Columbia. This is Rome. The president is Caesar. D.C. is Rome. The states over which D.C. rules are conquered territories. And conquered territories are only given military government delegated from the conqueror. And so all the state governments are military governments overseen by the commander-in-chief in D.C. through his military governors of the states. That's why you have the meeting of the governors with the commander-in-chief, what, once or twice a year. Commander-in-chief's telling the little commander-in-chiefs what to do. It's all military government, folks. And I'm going to teach you how we got there. So, Congress shall have power to declare war. Number two, when the nations or countries or states entered into the federal union, they delegated all war powers to the central government and retained no other war powers. That is very critical for you to know. Three, Time passes, and on October 6, 1917, when the United States goes into World War I in April of 1917, in October, the Congress passes an act on October 6, 1917. And that act is called Trading with the Enemy Act. Trading with the Enemy Act. This act regulated all trade and all transportation and all communication between the private citizens of the United States and the enemy citizens or subjects of the foreign nations that the country was at war with, which is perfectly acceptable. That's just fine. It was during World War I. And the Trading with the Enemy Act conferred a special jurisdiction on the district courts of the United States to enforce the provisions of Trading with the Enemy Act during World War I. That jurisdiction was a war powers jurisdiction, because Trading with the Enemy Act is passed out of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Congress shall have power to declare war. Trading with the Enemy Act springs from that particular section of Article 1. And so the jurisdiction that act conveys is a war powers jurisdiction. It is a military jurisdiction. And so this military jurisdiction was conferred on all the federal district courts with the Trading with the Enemy Act when enforcing the provisions of the Trading with the Enemy Act on October 6, 1917. So the federal district courts had civilian due process of law pursuant to Article 3 of the Constitution, where the federal courts had all cases in law and equity, common law and equity. That common law and equity is civilian due process of law in the federal courts. But they also had another jurisdiction that they could exercise, thanks to Trading with the Enemy Act, when it came to someone violating the provisions of Trading with the Enemy Act during World War I. And that was a war powers military jurisdiction. So do you see now there's both civilian jurisdiction and military jurisdiction in the federal district courts in 1917? Don't forget it. And that's just fine. For issues between private citizens in the country, they were always using civilian due process of law in criminal or civil matters. And when it came to a citizen violating Trading with the Enemy Act, trading with an enemy and thereby doing something where they're breaking the act, breaking the law, they could be tried in a military jurisdiction. Yep. And that was just fine during World War I. But the Jesuit order has more plans for this Trading with the Enemy Act. They have a greater purpose for it. Because their purpose is to bring the Trading with the Enemy Act inland, to impose that its military jurisdiction on all the federal and state courts during a time when there would be emergency war powers military government established over the national government and every state government. This is where they're going. This is where they went on March 9, 1933 with the government, and April 25, 1938 by imposing the military jurisdiction of the Trading with the Enemy Act on all the courts. It was a brilliant plan, and only the Jesuits could pull this off. They are the only ones that have the know-how and the historical knowledge and the knowledge of the law. Remember, Georgetown is a law center in D.C. Remember, Loyola in Chicago is a law center. Remember, the Jesuits have a law center in Los Angeles. They are the masters of the law. 1 out of 10 lawyers in this country is trained by Jesuits. They're the masters of the law. And so, in their design to impose emergency war powers military jurisdiction in the states, I want to bring you to our next step. So, after World War I, Trading with the Enemy Act should have been abolished. Remember, in Trading with the Enemy Act, there was what was called an alien property custodian. And any enemy during World War I who had property in this country, the alien property custodian seized it. And that alien property custodian at the end of World War I had some 30,000 trusts worth $500 million. Do you think the Jesuits, having that much money and power, would ever have Trading with the Enemy Act repealed? You know why they didn't have to have it repealed? Because it was an armistice. It was not the end of World War I. And so an armistice is merely a ceasefire, so they could keep Trading with the Enemy Act in place. And so from 1918, at the end of World War I, to 1930, the Trading with the Enemy Act was amended 14 times, fashioned, the word hoarding added 4 times to it, because the day would come when anybody that would be holding gold would be called hoarders under Trading with the Enemy Act, and the president would order its confiscation. On April 5th, 1933, to be turned in by communist fascist May 1st day, 1933. Anybody that was holding gold was a hoarder. They applied that term from Trading with the Enemy Act to Americans that were having their own gold, owning their own gold that they work for. And this would be the basis for the gold confiscation of FDR in 1933. And anybody that didn't turn in their gold or gold certificates by May 1st, Communist May 1st Day, they could be put in jail for 10 years with a $10,000 fine. Because now we didn't have civilian government anymore. We had emergency war powers military government in place. And under the doctrine of necessity, what is necessary to confiscate or to take for the war effort, the military government can do so. Called the doctrine of necessity. And so, from 1918 to 1930, TWEA, Trading with the Enemy Act, was amended 14 times in preparation for the Great Depression that would come in 1929, and the great, horrible, terrible suffering that American people would go through for 10 years from 1929 to 1939. So that when FDR would come to power, overseen by Jesuit Edmund Walsh of Georgetown University, he would come as the knight on the white horse to provide relief during this Great Depression that had been caused by papal knights like Joe Kennedy, who was the chief short seller of stock in 1929, while the Pope's Federal Reserve Bank withdrew 40% of all credit in circulation at that time, guaranteeing the stock market crash. And a justification to depart from civilian government and impose for a short time under the doctrine of necessity an emergency war powers military government. A war powers, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, military government. And it would be an emergency because it's going to be a banking emergency. So that's why we use the term emergency war powers military government. Number 5. On March 6, 1933, FDR issued Proclamation 2039. And in Proclamation 2039, he invokes Trading with the Enemy Act as the basis for this proclamation by calling everybody that's holding gold hoarders. And he uses the term 4 times. He also declares a national banking emergency where nobody can take any money out of their accounts for 4 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. A national banking holiday. He's declaring a national banking emergency. This is an emergency. And so, at the end of this banking holiday, at the end of this holiday, the Proclamation 2039 imposed, on March 9th, 1933, Congress met in an emergency session of Congress. FDR called for an emergency session of Congress for March 9th, 1933. Congress met and allegedly passed the Emergency Banking Relief Act. This wicked, evil, sinful, ungodly Emergency Banking Relief Act that, number one, approved and confirmed every proclamation the President and Secretary of Treasury would make beginning on March 4th to ad infinitum, hereafter. So every proclamation that a president or a secretary of treasury makes is automatically, ipso facto, approved and confirmed by the Congress going way back to March 9th, 1933, with the Emergency Banking Relief Act. That wicked, sinful, ungodly act that approved and confirmed these proclamations. But the second thing it did was it amended Trading with the Enemy Act, so, and removing certain words, so as to bring the Trading with the Enemy Act inside the country. So the enemy of the Trading with the Enemy Act became the person under the Emergency Banking Relief Act. And the persons defined in the Emergency Banking Relief Act are individuals, partnerships, associations, and corporations. They're all deemed to be persons under the Emergency Banking Relief Act that amended Trading with the Enemy Act that define these persons as enemies first. And I will also add, it's on this day, on the 6th, FDR seizes every piece of property, every person, every place, everything. Every piece of registered property was seized by the Commander-in-Chief, and he got legal title to it. That means you and me, we're all registered with the birth certificates. All registered property was seized on March 6th and approved and confirmed by the Congress on March 9th. And so Congress approved, allegedly approved, this seizure, although they really didn't approve it when you read the record, because it was passed without a roll call. No one had a copy of the Emergency Banking Relief Act. Nobody could read it. It was a terrible, awful thing, and Congressman Lundeen in the Congressional Record completely attacks it, and you need to read it, for which he was later murdered when he resisted this, the Methodist man of God that he was. So on March 9th, 1933, Congress passed the Emergency Banking Relief Act, confirms every proclamation of the President, Secretary of Treasury from March 4th to the present. That's called an open-ended credit card. Whatever you boys do down there, whatever the President, Secretary of Treasury does now, we approve it and confirm it, making him a constitutional dictator. Every president since FDR, I care not that they're Democrat or Republican, they're all constitutional dictators. Through Trading with the Enemy Act, Emergency Banking Relief Act, and Proclamation 2039, and then Proclamation 2040. That's what holds this empire together. You do away with the Emergency Banking Relief Act, everything crumbles. There's no more approving and confirming of these proclamations that put us under emergency war powers military government. There's no more approving and confirming that the Trading with the Enemy Act will be now brought inside the United States so that every court sits in a military jurisdiction. You want to do away with military jurisdiction in all these courts? You've got to repeal the Emergency Banking Relief Act. And so, number 7. Emergency Banking Relief Act amended TWIA, Trading with the Enemy Act, and brought it into the United States. And this is when the Trading with the Enemy Act will be the foundation for the Internal Revenue Code. They have all authority over every transaction that any U.S. citizen engages in, because there are no U.S. citizens until March 9th, 1933. We're all private citizens of the United States before March 9th, 1933. Where the Trading with the Enemy Act doesn't apply to us. But now, at March 9th, 1933, with the approval and confirming of all these proclamations of the President and Secretary of Treasury, including the seizure, why then we became enemies or persons, and our property became enemy property, so the military government can manage it to its delight, whatever it wants to do. And there are now not just 30,000 trusts, there's probably more like 250 million trusts. And the number of the trust is a social security number without the dashes, without the hyphens. Every U.S. citizen has a special trust account created by Proclamation 2039 of FDR, March 6, 1933. It's these accounts that the great lawyer from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and Cleveland, his name was Walker Todd, he said, without these accounts, we have no financial system in this country. So, after Emergency Banking Relief Act, later in the day, probably 8, 9 o'clock, after the Jesuits are having a party, because they've seized everything in this country. Everything. Every person, every place, everything. They own your dog. They own your cat. They own your shoes. They own your toothbrush. They own everything about you, boa, U.S. citizen, enemy belligerent. You own nothing. All you are is a custodian of the property you enjoy and that you paid for. You have no legal title to it whatsoever, and that includes your home. You read the congressional record on passing the Emergency Banking Relief Act. One of the congressmen says there, well, it appears that this act will act as a mortgage on all the homes and property of the people of the nation. You know what that means? That means you don't own the property. They have a lien on all your property when you want to go get credit. What do you think? We don't have fiat currency here. This currency is backed by every person, place, and thing in this country. And so, March 9th, 1933, with FDR's Proclamation 2040, he continues Proclamation 2039, during the state of emergency, and by the way, Congress has concluded a state of emergency is equal to a state of war, hence we're always at war, and that's why you got Bonesman 322, where they're always at war. Always. That's why Bush said, I'm a war president. Of course you are, Bush. Every president since FDR has been a war president. Because they're waging war around the world for this military government run by the Jesuits out of Georgetown and Fordham and all their other major universities and the four provincials here overseeing the major cities and the banking city of New York and the political city of D.C., and the military city of D.C., so that they're waging war around the world for the benefit of the Pope, and we're sending our young men and young women off to fight these crusades of the Pope, and has nothing to do with our personal sovereignty or for the benefit of the people. Nothing. We're all suckers. And they love playing us for suckers every day. Suckers. Time we woke up. Time we turn off the TV and stop watching the Super Bowl and all these other ridiculous, nonsensical sports and see what's been done to us. You're seized property. You're property of the Commander-in-Chief. And the Commander-in-Chief is run by the Pope of Rome. That's why every Commander-in-Chief goes to see that bastard. That spiritual bastard, Hebrews 12. He's not a saved man. He's not a son of God. He's a usurper. A vicar of Christ. He's a liar and a cheat. He's the head of the greatest syndicate in the world. It's the sovereign state of Vatican City with all of its agents worldwide, including the Mafia and the CIA and the FBI and the FSB and the SVR and the Mossad and all the intelligence communities, MI5, MI6, Pakistani ISI, German BND. All of it is tied together by the Jesuits out of Gregorian University in Rome. They control it all because all the governments of those nations are military governments. Every communist government is a military government. Every fascist government is a military government. All of them subject to the Pope of Rome and controlled by the Society of Jesus, the military order of the Society of Jesus, the most powerful secret society in the world. Having more power now than they've ever had in the past. So, we see now that we have a military government in place since March 9, 1933. Now I want to go and teach you about how they impose military jurisdiction. Now the classic work on this is titled Military Government and Martial Law by Berkheimer. It was published in 1912. I include it with my course. It's a division of the book into two halves. The first half is military government, the second half is martial law. In that book, it tells you that military jurisdiction is of two sorts. Military jurisdiction for military government and military jurisdiction for martial law. It's the same jurisdiction. So, how would the Jesuits impose this military jurisdiction out of Trading with the Enemy Act on the entire country? How could they do this? Well, they first have to get by Article 3, Section 2, Subdivision 1, which says, this is Article 3, which is judicial power, which we the people delegated to this government that we created for our benefit. Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. This is civilian due process of law, folks. In law means at common law and equity. Remember, the Jesuits hate common law. They love Roman civil law. Going back all the way to Justinian, taking it all the way back to Babylon and the Code of Hammurabi. Because in the common law, there's God-given fundamental rights that are protected by the government. Jesuits hate that. At the Roman civil law, everything is a privilege granted by the emperor or the dictator or the commander-in-chief. The Jesuits love Roman civil law. And their big purpose was to move us from American common law, as championed by the great Chancellor Kent, into a Roman civil law, as translated by, set forth by Sir Henry Maine in his book Ancient Law of 1864, thereabouts. So how do we impose an emergency war powers military jurisdiction on a historically white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation of people being busy living under the civilian due process of common law and civilian due process of equity? How do we move that to emergency war powers military due process of law, that jurisdiction? Well, that jurisdiction is already in place in 1917. It stays in place in the 1920s, 1930s, early 1930s. It's in place at the time military governments imposed on March 9, 1933. But so is civilian due process, it's in place. So civilian due process is not fit for a military government, because everybody in the country is deemed a U.S. citizen and enemy belligerent, and you can't give civilian due process at common law or equity to an enemy belligerent, to a person. So therefore, the Jesuits have to remove civilian due process from the federal district courts and the state courts. How are they going to do that? They're going to do it by controlling what's known as the Roosevelt Court. Franklin Damnable Roosevelt, 32nd degree Freemason and utter slave of Jesuit Edmund A. Walsh of Georgetown University. And he's going to do exactly what he's told by his Jesuit master. And so, he appoints two new Supreme Court justices after two conservative justices resign. And the two new justices are leftist, socialist, communist, Stanley Reed and Edward Black. Black and Reed. Yeah. And Black is a 33rd degree Freemason and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And that's the second Klan. And that's what FDR appointed to the Supreme Court. A Klansman. But all the leftist, socialist, communists will never tell you that FDR appointed a Klansman. Hugo Black. Oh no, because FDR is a god. He's sacrosanct, and we'd say nothing about him. That's why that evil, wicked Masonic Jew, Chucky Schumer, says, we're going to do what FDR did. And I'm sure you would, as he ruined this country with his filthy Roosevelt Court. And this Roosevelt Court with Hugo Black and that other justice he appointed, Stanley Reed, there are other justices there like the sinister Louis Brandeis, the first Jew to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And you have another Jew on there, Benjamin Cardozo. And you have the Chief Justice, Hughes. And you have another very sinister justice on that court. And you will have this decision of known as the Erie Railroad Company versus Tompkins of 1938. 304 U.S. 64. And it's in this decision where the Supreme Court, without the question being brought to the court, remember, the Supreme Court's not deciding anything unless the question has been brought to it from the lower court, the appellate court, the Circuit Court of Appeals, to the Supreme Court. They can't decide anything unless a legitimate question is put to them. In this decision, the Supreme Court decided that they were abolishing federal general common law, not just federal common law. Federal common law exists today. It's judge-made law by case. They're abolishing the federal general common law of that great case that had been cited by Joseph Story in 1842. It was a unanimous decision. And they will overturn that case, and the Erie decision will say there's no more federal general common law. Meaning we were abolishing civilian due process at common law. They left equity untouched. They left the civilian due process of equity untouched to be in chambers for an identity hearing. You can't litigate in it, but it was not taken away because that's how the big boys are not going to be tried for their crimes, because they will prove that they're not this U.S. citizen, and they will get an identity hearing in chambers, and they'll tell the judge who they are, and therefore the judge has no personal jurisdiction over them to implement emergency war powers military due process. That's how that works. And so there's no more common law, federal general common law, in the federal courts. They only have now their judge-made federal common law that they make it deciding on a case-by-case basis. That's not what was abolished by the Erie decision. Because what was abolished by the Erie decision was, in effect, the abolishing of civilian due process in the federal district courts. That's what they did. And when they made that decision, they not only did that, but they overlaid all the state courts' jurisdiction with this federal emergency war powers military jurisdiction. There is no state court in this country that sits in a state war powers military jurisdiction. They're flying military colors. I've been in most of these county courts. I've been in Lebanon County, Berks County, Dauphin County, all the counties here in Pennsylvania, they're all flying military colors. Does the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, have a right to impose a war powers military jurisdiction on their courts when they delegated all their war powers to the central government when they became a state of the Union? Therefore, it has to be federal. It has to be federal emergency war powers military jurisdiction in every state. The civilian due process is still there if you'll invoke it. I invoked it in a case here in Lebanon. It was a 2-year case. I got 10 decrees in exclusive equity. Civilian due process, it's still there. But nobody knows that. And I'll tell you why. I'll go off on a little tangent here. Every attorney is a JAG. They are military attorneys. Every bar card attorney is a military attorney. Every bar card judge is a military judge. Because they're sitting in emergency war powers military jurisdiction. And that's why you have to have a emergency war powers attorney, a JAG attorney. What I mean JAG is a judge advocate general. They're a judge advocate general's office in effect. They're de facto judge advocate general's attorneys. Practicing their law in a military jurisdiction. And not one judge will ever admit this to you. They will not deny it, but they will not admit it. That shows you these criminal judges, state and federal, are sitting in a jurisdiction you know nothing about, flying military colors in your face, thinking you're nothing but a bunch of stupid idiots, while they proceed against you in a military jurisdiction, treating you like an enemy belligerent called a person. That's how it works, folks. That's how your courts work. That's how this government works. It's an emergency war powers military government, state and federal level. All both courts, state and federal, sitting in a federal emergency war powers military jurisdiction of Section 17 of the Trading with the Enemy Act, and it's now codified at 50 U.S.C. 4316. You look it up. Title 50 U.S.C. United States Code, Section 4316, where the Congress gives a special jurisdiction of Trading with the Enemy Act to the district courts to to enforce Trading with the Enemy Act. But guess what? We're all under Trading with the Enemy Act now. We're all enemies now. We're all under a military-occupied government. This country's been under military occupation since March 9th, 1933. What do you think we have with all these bases here? It's a military government. I call this thing the Pope's Holy Roman, 14th Amendment, Socialist, Communist, Corporate Fascist, American Empire. It's a world empire governed by a military government controlled by the Jesuits on behalf of the Pope of Rome that they're going to make one day the Antichrist. And we people, we American people, are facilitating this. We're sending our sons and daughters off to fight in this crusade after crusade after crusade for the Pope of Rome. It's not for us. I remember one time I was talking with one lady, and she said her son came back from Iraq, and he had his arm blown off, and I started to cry. I said, "I'm sorry, ma'am, I can't talk anymore." All of our young men and women, many, many have come back crippled, blind, burned. What for? It's for the Pope's crusades, not for us. They're not fighting for America. When I found out how I was used, like this in the Mare Force for nearly 5 years, when I found out how I was used, garrisoned in Germany for 3.5 years because we're going to fight the Cold War and fight the Soviets, that was all a lie. All a lie. I asked my commander, I said, Colonel Wood, I said, how is it that the MiG-25 looks just like the F-15? Don't tell me the Russians have the ability to devise those kind of things. They're in slavery. They have no desire to do that. It was given to them by this military government to keep parity. They do it all the time. So, what we have here is we have the Erie Railroad decision doing away with civilian due process of law, then the vacuum being filled by the Trading with the Enemy Act. Military jurisdiction, and that's what we have in every federal and every state court. And every time you walk into a courtroom and you see military colors there, you know the judge knows exactly what she's enforcing. Because they hate you. These judges hate you. I know a couple judges are not that way. I have two judges in Lebanon County here. They're decent men. And when I confronted them with a military due process, they didn't say a word. And one of them gave me my decree. Inequity. The great Samuel Klein. And then the other one's a president judge, the great John C. Tilwalk. We have two of the finest judges in this whole state. Because if you invoke civilian due process as a moving party, they will sit in it. But if you submit to the Emergency War Powers military due process of somebody who wants to sue you or of some prosecutor, they'll go along with it if you don't say anything. One of the purposes for my course, my private American citizenship course, is to get your status straightened out so you can ultimately put paper into the court to say you're not this all caps enemy belligerent. And you're not subject to any emergency war powers military due process, and you do not consent to this. And judge, have you taken an oath to uphold the Constitution? Because if you have, then you have to give me civilian due process or dismiss this case. And if you don't, you're in breach of your oath to office. You're in violation of your oath of your sacred trust. One thing's for sure, we cannot go along with this anymore. Because when we consent to this, my son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Proverbs 1:10. And every time someone serves process on you for a lawsuit, they're enticing you into the military jurisdiction of the court, and you are not to consent to that. And you got to know how not to consent to it. You got to have status not to consent to it. So, this emergency war powers overlaid military jurisdiction, overlaid the civilian due process jurisdiction of all the states. So our major conclusion is that on March 9th, 1933, emergency war powers military government was established over the federal government, or actually the national government since 1868 with the 14th Amendment, and over every state government. Every state governor is a commander-in-chief of his conquered territory, Pennsylvania. And we, the people that have consented to it, because we consented to be to be registered property by way of a birth certificate. We all consented to that, and it's our fault. And they have plausible deniability. Well, if you would know your status and how you got there, you could reverse it, and we wouldn't treat you this way, like an enemy belligerent. But oh no, they want to keep us good and occupied with a fighting hockey game where these guys can beat themselves to death. We got to be occupied by a couple of black men beating each other to death in a boxing ring, so we can be occupied with that and not know where in the name of Christ we went astray and why we're treated the way we are by this government, by this military government. It comes up all the time. Well, the government's doing this to this and doing that to this, and it's persecuting us, and it's destroying our food. What do you think they're supposed to do? It's an enemy, belligerent people that's being warred upon by the emergency war powers, military government, in their destruction pursuant to what I've just taught you. They're going to destroy all these chickens. They're going to starve you. They're going to kill these cattle. They want to starve you to death, boy, enemy belligerent. They want to jack you up with a COVID injection to kill you within 2 to 5 years, enemy belligerent. And the leading Jesuit that's going to lead the way is Jesuit Fauci. When are we going to wake up? They're waging war against us. It doesn't matter if it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. He's a commander-in-chief, he's subject to the Pope, and he's going to continue to wage war on us. Wait till Trump starts a huge war in the Middle East, because it's coming. Over this Gaza fiasco. Wait until we have a go to war with China, because this military government's given China all their technology. The Chinese couldn't invent jack diddly unless we were given all of our military secrets and technology. This government of Washington, run by the Pope, built our enemies to invade us. And so, I want to share with you a case that I was involved in on Monday with a mortgage foreclosure with a dear friend of mine, and I'm going to read a portion of it to you just so that the judge heard what I'm going to say to you now. I read it to the judge because the individual I was with is legally blind, and he asked the judge if I could read this in court, and she consented, though tongue-in-cheek. So, as usual, the judge saved us for the last individuals in court. And so she calls my friend up, Aaron. I get permission to speak for him in reading this script. And she's not real happy about it, but she permits it to be read into the record so we can get a record of this from the court reporter on appeal. So here is the opening statement for the defendant who's being sued in a mortgage foreclosure so they can take his house from him. Your Honor, for the record, I have some issues of status, fundamental right, and jurisdiction that were not addressed by the plaintiff in my counterclaim. The plaintiff is the attorney for the bank, who was late, and the judge decided to wait for him. Now, if I was late in a case like that, they'd rule against me right now. But since it's attorney, since it's a JAG, since it's a bar card attorney, and the judge's a bar card attorney, they're a little brotherhood here, so we're going to go ahead and we're going to call another attorney to have this attorney who missed the time to proceed so that they can have a little substitute there. The judge should have said, the bank's not here, and they were to be here at such and such a time, so I'm dismissing this case without prejudice so they can bring it back. And maybe the attorney will be responsible enough to show up in court. But oh no, that woman judge there kissing up to her bar card attorney's firm protects that incompetent attorney from not showing up in court and gets somebody else there. A sin. That's a sin on her part. So, continuing, I would like to address those matters before a plaintiff proceeds to the merits of the case, because you can't raise issues of jurisdiction or errors on the part of the moving party after you address the merits of the case. I didn't do that. Yeah, I did that. You can't do that. You got to do this first. And the judge knows it. So the judge allowed me to read this into the record. So I read, since the plaintiff did not answer my counterclaim, I hereby make a motion for the court to dismiss this case without prejudice so that the plaintiff can come back and properly refile its case with the following corrections. All we want him to do is come back and properly refile. I don't want them to amend the case. You're a military jurisdiction if you amend. Dismiss the case without prejudice. That means you can come back. Set the court in the civilian due process. Get rid of those military colors. Address me in my proper name. And I will be happy to plead to the merits. Just fix the errors. So I say, so that the plaintiff can come back and properly refile his case with the following corrections. A, use my lawful name of upper and lowercase name, spelled in both upper and lowercase letters, being a matter of public judicial record on file with the court. Because our declaration of status is filed in Harrisburg, and it defines all this, and now it's on the record of this particular case in court. You have evidence. Evidence is everything. The rules of evidence. Every judge is bound by the rules of evidence. B, set the court in its civilian due process of law, a common law or in equity, which is my fundamental right as a non-combatant, pre-March 9th, 1933, private citizen of the United States, said status, right, and jurisdiction secured by Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. Hey, proceed against me with civilian due process. I'm not going to submit to this military due process. I don't have to. I'm not an enemy belligerent. I'm a citizen, a glorious citizen, a pre-March 9th, 1933 private citizen, the status we all had before March 9th, 1933, when we were all private citizens with a fundamental right to civilian due process of law, as secured by a great Supreme Court case titled Hale versus Hinkle in 1906. The citizen has a right to due process of law, and there it is civilian due process. It's not military. I go on. I am neither an quote-unquote enemy slash person defined by the Federal Trading with the Enemy Act of October 6, 1917, as amended on March 9, 1933 by the Federal Emergency Banking Relief Act, quote-unquote, nor am I a belligerent, quote-unquote, as defined by Article 23H of the Hague Convention, said treaty regulating the laws of land warfare. You see, the military government is waging war on every person here. Under every enemy belligerent here. And what regulates the laws of land warfare is the Hague Convention that was entered into by this civilian government in 1907. And you can't treat me like an enemy belligerent. I'm a national under Article 23H of the Hague Convention. Therefore, you cannot suspend my right to civilian due process of law under the Hague Convention. Not to mention Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which is civilian due process of law for the private citizen. Further, since I have accepted the oaths of the officers of this court, the plaintiff is bound by both federal and state constitutions to set the court. The judge said to my friend, what do you mean set the court? Setting the court. And the moving party always sets the court. Setting the court in civilian due process or military due process. And my friend wasn't that adept to answer that. What do you mean by set the court? Hey, that shows you that the judge is your enemy. Not just the moving party, but you got to fight with the judge too. They're biased against you. You're an enemy. They're not going to let you out of their clutches of being an enemy belligerent, boa. We're going to shove military jurisdiction down your throat unless you have something to say that's going to bind me where I cannot do it, like in violation of my oath where I can be sanctioned by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. You got to know how to do that. They're not going to do the right thing unless they're forced to. They're bullies. They're typical Roman Catholic bullies. And I was raised with the Irish Catholics and the Italian Catholics. And I'll tell you, the vast majority of them are bullies. That's why they do so well in the mafia, as bullies. They're going to bully you into that jurisdiction when you have a right to civilian due process. So we go on. Since I have accepted the oaths of the officers of this court, the plaintiff is bound by both federal and state constitutions to set the court in its civilian due process of law, as opposed to federal emergency war powers military jurisdiction due process of law imposed by Title 50, United States Code 4316, evidenced by federal and state military flags on display in this court. And when I said that, she looked at me, but she didn't deny it. The judge didn't deny it. The feminist judge didn't deny it. The unrighteous judge didn't deny it. She didn't. Why didn't she say, what do you mean military jurisdiction in this court? We're not sitting in military jurisdiction. They would never say that because they know they are. And I challenge you, any of you listening to me, and you have any friends that are judges, you ask them. Ask them. Are you sending emergency war powers, military jurisdiction, evidenced by the military colors on display in your court? Ask them the question. I ask a prosecuting attorney that in Idaho. I like her. Nice lady. I taught her my class for 2 days. I said, would you please go back and ask the president judge if he's sitting in emergency war powers, military due process? I got nothing from her. Nothing. That's a question you do not raise. That is a sacrosanct secret of the Bar Association, that we're all JAGs, that we're all sitting on behalf of the Commander-in-Chief of the state or the Commander-in-Chief of the United States. And woe be to you if you raise that issue, because they're not going to address it. I raised the issue with the Judge Christopher Connor in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. I left a package off with him. I'm a private citizen. Show me how to interface with your military government. Got nothing back from him. Because the moment he opens his mouth, and the moment any of these judges agree that they're in military jurisdiction, they're going to get a bomb on their porch, and they're going to be blown to smithereens by some CIA or mafioso that allowed that when you betrayed the secret of the brotherhood, of the judicial brotherhood, you get to die. That's how deep the secret runs. There is no judge that I've ever known. There's only one lawyer, and his name was Stamper. And he wrote a great book called Fruit from a Poisonous Tree. And the guy's name is Melvin Stampler, who left the country and died in Puerto Rico. And he's the only attorney that ever came out and said, we're under emergency war powers, military jurisdiction. March 9th, March 6th, all of it's in his book. Fruits from a Poisonous Tree. Get it and read it and weep. And so I put in closing, every statement given above has been sworn to under the penalties of perjury. I stand mute and do not intend to address the merits of the case until these claims are answered by the plaintiff. And when I finished that, the judge said, and that's enough, because she read this. And she didn't want me to read the rest into the record. But here's the rest. If the judge wants to proceed, one thing she did ask him, did you get a loan? She's going to the merits of the case when she knows very good and well we're not going to the merits of the case till we resolve this matter of proper name, civilian due process, and then we can go to the merits of the case. So she's working with the plaintiff to get the mortgage foreclosure finalized and the order signed. She's the enemy too. And you got to talk up to these people. You can't be nice to them. You got to talk up to them. You got to be firm with them. This is the way it is. I'm not submitting this military jurisdiction. I don't have to. And if you're going to proceed, you're in violation of your oath to the Constitution. Start getting up and walking out. And if she issues an order, well, I will appeal that she's now in breach of her oath, and you want her to be sanctioned by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court for violating my right, my fundamental right to civilian due process of law, and to address me by my upper and lower case name. I am not that all uppercase name. That's not me. That's my principle. It's a trust, and I'm a beneficiary of it. Read my paperwork, Judge. It's right in the paperwork. Did you read anything that I put in the court? So, let the record show the court is not going to honor its oath of office to uphold my fundamental right to civilian due process of law, secured by Section 1 of the 14th Amendment and Article 23H of the Hague Convention. She didn't let me read that. And the last one, therefore I request the judge recuse herself that she may not be sanctioned by the Supreme Court of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for violating her oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. She would not allow me to read those last two paragraphs. And then she just proceeded. She was so arrogant. When I stepped up after she ruled against my friend, and I said, well, we'd like to have a transcript. She turned to me and she says, Eric, you can't represent him. I just asked for the transcripts, for the stenographer there. See these little tyrants, these little feminazi tyrants? You put these women in places of judgeship and they turn into a feminazi tyrant. Almost as bad as the men. Not quite, though. So in conclusion, I want you to know that we have been under emergency war powers military government since March 9, 1933. We have been made subject to emergency war powers military jurisdiction since April 25, 1938. And they've been flying their military colors in our face the whole time, laughing at us. Look at those fools. Don't they know we're in military jurisdiction? Those fools claiming constitutional rights and fundamental rights. This is military. They're enemy belligerents. All they have is privileges granted from the commander-in-chief and the military government of their state when they pass these statutes. They're all just military statutes of a military Congress enforced in a military court. And the toughness enforced by the police under the military executive branch. It's all military. And if you think Donald Trump is going to reverse this, you're quite out of your mind. I was associated with a late gentleman, Christopher Earl Strunk, who when he ran for president several years ago, he ran on one platform, and that was to repeal the Emergency Banking Relief Act. That's it. Wasn't long after that, a couple years after that, he turns up dead. See, Chris wasn't saved, didn't know the Lord. When you resist these people, you better be saved, you better be right with God, you better be serious about it, and trust the Lord for his providence and protection and provision. If not, you're done. Your goose is cooked, and you will be pushing up daisies someplace. Because the devil is not going to allow his Pope's Jesuitical military government and jurisdiction to be overthrown in North America. We are the great restorers of the Pope's temporal power by this filthy military government that he imposed on us on March 9, 1923. And I believe and I preach and teach that no Bible-believing Christian can ever be a member of the U.S. Armed Forces. Can't do it and be right with God. You got to get out. And that's how I'm teaching now how young men, if they're going to be drafted, how to avoid the draft. How so that you can't be drafted. You're not the all-caps entity. You're not surety. You're not obligor. You're not trustee. And this is not me. If you want to draft this all-caps entity, here's my birth certificate. Help yourself. In conclusion, may the Lord grant us all repentance to live a pure life, to resist this unto blood, striving against sin, Hebrews 12:4. And that the Lord would do that which seemeth good to him. Brother Eric John Phelps, 24/7 World Radio Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, for listening. I have a book, Vatican Assassins, Wound in the House of My Friends. Go to my website, vaticanassassins.org. Pick up an ebook. Go to 24/7 World Radio. Listen to past broadcasts, and there's other things you can obtain. Take my courses, my private citizenship class, my advanced class, and my tax class. They're all offered there. Consider getting a trust where your property is protected. You own nothing and yet you use everything. There are things you can do, but first and foremost, are you saved? Are you in Christ? Have you had your sins forgiven? Have you believed the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, that he died for your sins, was buried, and rose again? Have you? 1 Corinthians 15:1-4. If you have, with true repentance coupled with that faith, then you're saved, you're in Christ, you're sealed to the day of redemption, and the Lord wants to use you for his purposes. One of the purposes is to resist the mystery of iniquity with the armor of God of Ephesians chapter 6. So until we meet again, you may send your donations to RBPB Church, or RBT, P.O. Box 306, Newmanstown, Pennsylvania, 17073. Or you can send it by Cash App as Cash Tag, Eric, E-R-I-C, John, J-O-N, Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S. Cash Tag with that name. Or you can send it by PayPal to RBPB, donate at Comcast.net. Appreciate your giving. Thank you for your gifts of the past, of recent past. Thank you, Brother Mosley, for your gift. Thank you, sister, for your gift that I received today. And I'll use it all to this end while paying the bills to sustain a family. So until next time we meet, may the Lord bless you as you're doing his will according to his word. The AV 1611 Reformation English Bible in its present edition of 1769. Until then, Maranatha.